This episode of the Daily Brief podcast is brought to you by 2C Creative, an award-winning agency that crushes it on everything from 360 integrations to live action, design, trailers, and editorial. Hello, I'm Paige Albiniak, Editorial Director of Promax BDA. Today, I have with me Maria Rapitskaya, Founder and Creative Director of Brooklyn-based Undefined Creative, a boutique media production agency that works with household names such as the NFL, NBC Universal, Better Homes and Gardens, and the United Nations. Do I have all that correct, Maria?
Everything except for the NFL. We'd love to work with them, but we work with the NHL.
Oh, NHL.
But if NFL is listening, they should call us.
I did say NHL. That's my bad. Well, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to talk to you today.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So Maria has many pet passions, some of which she's written about for us at Daily Brief. We're going to talk about some of them today in the kickoff episode of a series that I am casually calling The Agency of the Future. And what I mean by this is that I'm going to talk to heads of creative agencies about how they are adapting to two rapidly changing environments: the traditional TV environment, which we all know has been completely upended by streaming services and on-demand offerings, and the traditional work environment, which also has been upended by the internet and the changing desires of the workforce. There's probably some more things that are getting upended, but we'll start there. So Maria, to kick it off, can you just give us a little rundown on your background? What brought you to this point?
Sure. So I started in motion graphics officially in 99. And for the first 5 or 6 years, I was staff at a post-production facility and, came up through working in TV on, with all the technology hiccups of the early 2000s, the tape deliveries and FedExing things out with 10 p.m. messengers and all that good stuff. And then once I quit my full-time position, I spent a couple of years freelancing and at that point realized that that was also not for me. I decided to start up a company, and that lasted for about three to five years, depends on how you look at it. We were sort of glorified freelancers for a while, and then transitioned to really just working with our own clients. I had a partner. And then once that fell apart, I thought, okay, what am I going to do now? And I realized that going back to work for someone else was really not an option anymore. So I had just one thing to do, which was to try and reboot and start another company. So in 2010, I started Undefined Creative and really had no idea of where it was going to go, honestly. But it turned out pretty successful enough to still be up and running. We're at 3.5 people now, 3 full-timers and 1 part-timer who will hopefully be full-time within the next 6 months. And then, we work with a really wide range of clients, and only about 50%, possibly even less, is in broadcast these days.
Right. So what initially made you decide to go freelance?
A lot of it had to do, I think, with my background. My mom was an independent entrepreneur, and she worked from home basically the entirety of her life. And so I didn't realize how much of it had sunk into my conscience. So, kind of going in and staying on a 9 to 5, 9 to 6 clock, and that's the best case scenario, as you can imagine. It just really wasn't for me. I did it, and it was a wonderful experience, but I realized that I wanted to be a lot more in charge of how my day went and when I took vacation and how long I took for vacation. So it was really just a quality of life decision more than anything else.
So I'm also freelance, essentially, but I mean, I find my own life is still pretty, this is probably my own fault, but I'm still pretty much on a schedule. But do you find, as a freelancer, and now you run a company, so maybe it's different, but do you find that you get to keep that freedom, or how has that panned out for you?
Well, when I was freelance, I realized that I was a little bit too optimistic about how much freedom freelancing really provided. I probably worked later hours as a freelancer than I ever did when I was staff. And I think that was also kind of a big realization, where it was 3 a.m. and I was still in the studio, and I said, well, what am I doing here? I'm not even invested in this company. I just sort of come and go. Why am I here at 3 a.m.? So it really wasn't until I started my own business that I really began to experiment with how to arrange my schedule in a way that really suits my life. And it's an ongoing experiment. Circumstances change, our production schedule changes. And so, as you said, it's not as balanced and free floating as people would imagine when I say that I'm in control of my schedule. But, I'm still able to take a decent amount of time off, which is not something I would ever be able to do otherwise. And I'm able to be flexible with things like doctor's appointments or hitting the gym. And I can do that not just for myself, but also for the folks who work with me.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that a little bit later. But, it's funny because I think the reason that as a freelancer, you're still in the studio at 3 a.m., I'm personally never working at 3 a.m., but when you're freelance, you're really investing in yourself. And when you work for staff, I think there's just a safety net of a company that makes you feel like, well, I can leave at 5, I come back at 8 or whatever, and that's still going to be there. But when you're freelance, you're like, I'm on my own here. You're beholden to a different set of rules, I think.
Yeah, I kind of thought, in some way it was the worst of both worlds for me. And I know that there are a lot of people out there would completely disagree with that. I think it's, very much a personality-based thing. But for me, I still felt a ton of responsibility for the projects that I was working on, but none of the sort of benefits that come with being an actual part of a team.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you talked about your mom, but I don't know if I have this correct, but you are a first-generation immigrant, or did your mom come first?
My mom and I came together in 89.
Okay. So, she's sort of a trailblazer there that she was working from home.
Oh, she was actually breaking a lot of rules in the former Soviet Union by running a business.
Yeah.
Which is, something I didn't really understand until I was a grown-up. And looking back on my childhood, I thought, wow, go mom.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. All right. So can you describe a little bit more what Undefined Creative is, how it operates, and sort of how you have it all set up?
Sure. As of the moment, like I said, we're 3.5 employees. The half is actually just starting early next week. So it's myself as the creative director, and I've got an executive producer named Kathy. And trivia is that Kathy and I met in our freshman year of high school and just happened to go into the same field professionally. We have a full-time animator, Steven, who is absolutely fantastic. And, we're putting on the team right now a gal who is a very recent graduate who's going to be basically a production artist / assistant in whatever way we need her to help out. Obviously, plenty of freelancers on a need-be basis. The interesting things about the shop is we have never had an office. Everybody's remote. Strangely, all four of us now, are all Brooklyn-based. However, Brooklyn is a very big borough, and the amount of time that we're saving on commuting and, traffic is still pretty tremendous. For my executive producer, for example, to go round trip would probably be about 2.5 hours on a good day. So, we meet about once a week, sometimes once every 2 weeks, sometimes twice a week, really just kind of depending on what the production schedule requires. Everyone is self-managing in as much as, the projects allow. There's really sort of the bare minimum oversight. We don't believe in standing over people's shoulders and, sort of prodding them to do good work. We're simply just careful about the people that we hire, especially with our freelance artists. Most of our freelance people we've been working with for probably upwards of 10 years. So it's people we know really well and people we trust. So what else can I tell you?
But do you guys meet in person or do you meet, like in a chat room or?
So we have, we're on Slack all day long. That's our bare minimum of communication. We try to start every single day with a conference call between everyone. Mm-hmm. And then, if it's whether it's freelance or staff people. And then as we go through the production schedule and all the to-dos for the day, certain people drop off. And then at that point, just my P and I go through whatever operations and marketing and anything else that's going on for the day as far as our to-do list. And then, like I said, about once a week on average, I've got a sort of a live-work setup. And we meet here, hang out for however long we need to, go through everything from catching up on, you know, just general chit chat and sort of the water cooler talk, catching up on production. When we do have projects that are very involved that are starting up, we'll try to meet a little bit more often just to, you know, get that FaceTime and that creative discussion. But by and large, you know, we're quite used to working this way. So it really doesn't present any challenges or, you know, I don't see any part of it as a setback. If anything, I think we're all far more productive without wasting any energy on commuting. And I think people just appreciate the fact that, you know, so much trust is being put into them with respect to, you know, you've got your hours, you know what you're doing. If you need to take a break, just give a shout on Slack, and that's it.
How much of your business would you say is conducted by people who are freelancers or contractors who aren't actually employees?
As little as we possibly can manage. I would say we try to keep it to about 60 to 70% staff.
Okay.
The only difference would be if, you know, if it's production related work, because we don't have a DP on staff, you know, we don't have crews. So that would be the probably the bigger place where we would work with outside contractors.
Right. Because that stuff, I think, generally is contracted out by most people anyway. But what I was thinking is that Undefined Creative had more of like a loose network of freelancers that you guys worked with. But actually, I didn't realize that you had three staffers. But it is interesting that you have this decentralized, very, I don't know about home-based, but internet digital-based way of communicating and working, which I think is a different model.
You know, up until last summer, we actually operated with just two full-time people. So it was myself and my EP, and everyone else was freelance. But we got to the point where we were spending so much money on freelancers, and we were using them consistently enough. You know, I'm very hands-on, and that's not a part of my job that I ever want to lose or give up. But, you know, it got to the point where there was really only so much that I could manage, and we were relying more and more heavily on freelance help. And at some point we said, you know, we've got to bring on somebody full time.
At what point did you feel like the balance tipped and you said it makes more sense to have an employee than a freelancer?
You know, I think I started feeling it about 5 years in. So that would have been around 2015. And then it was probably about a year before we, A, committed the finances, and B, found the right person and went through the whole process of trying to find someone. Because, you know, part of the setup of the studio is that it's not a great situation for some people. For example, if you thrive on happy hours with your coworkers, it's just not part of our culture. You know, we're people who are in our, you know, mid to late 30s. You know, everyone loves their job, but, you know, at the end of the day, we just all want to go home to our significant others and families and other interests. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that whoever we found was really the right fit, and didn't feel like they were missing out on working from an office.
Right. Is that hard to suss out from people?
You know, I think we tried to be very, very descriptive in the post right from the start. We did a pretty extensive interview process. And I think a lot of it, you know, came out in the interviews just because of people's family situations, their preferences, their circumstances. Steven, whom we just hired, you know, he's a new dad. So that just worked out, you know, perfectly for him, that, you know, together with having a daughter, he didn't have this crazy commute back and forth into the city. And, you know, for as much as obviously he's still on the clock, I'm sure it's helpful when you're home.
Right. So kind of along these lines, an issue that you've written about a fair amount is work-life balance. I feel like that's very important to you. It sounds like you've created your business around accommodating that for yourself and for the people that work for you. So what's your take on work-life balance? And do you feel like it's a real thing that can be attained? Is it a myth? Is it everything in moderation? What's your take on it?
So I think work-life balance, as, you know, sort of this pop culture listicle idea, is a myth. Because the reality of it is, it's not something that you can build until you realize what that means to you. And Work-life balance means completely different things for different people. My life, for example, would feel completely unbalanced to someone else because I'm one of these people who's completely fine to work on the weekends, work late if I have to, as long as I know that, you know, I've got my vacation booked and I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks. And I'm going to disconnect and I'm not going to check email. Other people, you know, for them, it's really more of a daily balance where, you know, they need to make sure that they're only working from 9 to 5, or maybe they're happiest working from 7 to 3. Right. So it's really about figuring out what your sort of most productive hours are, how you prefer to work. Like, are you kind of a marathoner, or, you know, do you need sort of that day-to-day maintenance? And then, you know, starting from that, I think a lot of problems with work-life balance is it makes you feel like there's just this one formula out there that's a fits-all. And it's not a one-size-fits-all kind of deal. And until you figure out what work-life balance actually means to you, it's like chasing a ghost. You're never going to find it.
Right. So do you think that there's a way for employers to accommodate that work-life balance? Or do you think that's really up to the employer, the freelancer, to sort of figure out what it is that they need and make that happen for themselves?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, we are still living in a society that expects us to be at our desks between certain hours and, you know, respond during certain hours, even though the technology has freed us to not be so rigid with our time.
I mean, don't you feel like the technology has done is, instead of saying it's freed us, I mean, this is how I feel. Instead of the technology freeing me, it's meant that people can reach me at any time, and they do. And that is
true.
Not freeing. Like,
true.
Don't,
true.
I don't
However,
want to talk to you at 7 o'clock at night.
However, that means that you can be wherever you want to be throughout the day. And if you feel like going to the gym at, you know, 3 p.m., if that is what really makes you happy, I use that example because that's what really makes me happy. I know that I can go and take that time. And if something really urgent comes up, people can find me. I think part of it is, you know, we've also gotten used to sort of bothering each other with things that are not necessarily urgent at all times of day and night. And, you know, that's unfortunately just a sort of a cultural fallout of having the technology. You know, but with respect to your earlier question, I think it's going to take some time before, you know, the general business world catches up to the reality of this sort of potential for
right.
the flexibility in our lives that we can now manage. For us, I would be thrilled to allow people to work whatever hours they feel like, frankly. The only thing that's preventing me from that is that, unfortunately, our clients still expect us to be here during certain hours.
And they need to be there, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's really, you know, right now, that's really more of a hang-up. So, you know, my solution to that is to say, all right, guys, you know, we have to be a 9-to-5, 9-to-6 shop, but within that bracket, as long as there's someone here holding down the fort at all times to make sure that, you know, clients are taken care of, if you need to take your kid to a doctor's appointment, if you need to take a few hours, you know, to go help out a family member, whatever it is, go do it.
Yeah. Do you, you wrote a piece about this and you talked about it a little bit before, but what are some questions or what are some things you think people need to figure out in terms of determining what their own work-life balance needs are?
So, you know, for me, the first thing I started with was trying to figure out when it is that I'm actually productive. And unfortunately, that's not something that you get to figure out when you're working a full-time job that just requires certain hours of you. But I remember, you know, that 2, 3, 4 p.m. slump, and I was practically asleep. You know, there was no productive work that could come out of me during those hours, no matter how hard I tried, no matter how many cups of coffee I drank. And so one of the most interesting things that happened to me when I started really just, you know, working for my own studio was I realized that I was very happy waking up at, you know, 6 a.m., something that was torture to me when I had to go into an office. I never realized I was a morning person before. But all of a sudden, I realized that if I get up at 6 and I actually start my day early, it's amazing. Like, it's incredible. I'm so massively productive. And that way, by 2, 3 p.m., when I'm just hitting a wall, I could take a couple hours off because I've already accomplished a ton, or I can schedule my calls during those times, or I can, you know, save, you know, very particular tasks for, you know, that sort of for my slump time. And then if I still need to put in more hours, I'll do it at, you know, 5, 6 when I'm feeling much better. And so, you know, that's a pretty small change to make. But, you know, honestly, in terms of productivity and freeing up some time for yourself, that was huge for me.
So, and then you and I have both heard of the 10-hour work week. I've heard Tim Ferriss talk about it a fair amount. I read the book, but I think we also both agree that that's also a myth. I don't think there's any way.
Absolutely.
I'm like the 10-hour work day, but I think people are also resisting that 40-hour 9-to-6 day or whatever. Is there anything besides that, what you just said, move your schedule, is there anything people can do to either increase their productivity or move their schedule around so they can do more in less time?
So I think working during the hours when you're actually productive is huge. I think finding ways in which you are most productive is also huge. For me, I am not someone who works well when there's 20 other people around me. The people who work with us are not people who work well that way too. So we're all actually able to be far more productive because we're working in our own homes with our own setups. And we can close our door and there's not another soul that's going to walk in and bother us, right? And so because the communication is via Slack, I can simply tell people, guys, I'm going on 911 right now and don't bother me unless it really is a genuine emergency. And then I put my laptop away, I go to my desktop, and I'm actually working. So a lot of it is, you know, is also having to learn how to discern between what is really sort of emergency necessity and what is just noise.
Yeah,
and
it's hard.
You know, frankly, a lot of it is noise. Of the 50 plus emails that I get throughout the day, actually don't even know, frankly, what that number is. I'm just sort of guessing. You know, one or two are going to be things that are genuinely urgent and need immediate response.
Yeah.
Everything else can wait until I'm ready. And yeah, if I check my email once every 3 hours, that is really not terrible.
Yeah. I'm so tethered to email. That is bad. But yeah, I think that is a hindrance for people. All right. I'm going to switch gears from this and move toward, you talk and write a lot about, this is a big switch, a gear switch, but you talk and write a lot about the practice of the free pitch and how you feel it should be banished to the past. Can you tell me why you feel that way?
Oh, I certainly can. So look, obviously, you know, we are a really small studio. And I started this company with $500, basically just so that they would let me open up a checking account. And we've never relied on investment. We've never relied on even salespeople, frankly. You know, we're sort of the quintessential little mom and pop business that is trying to stay afloat in what is increasingly a more hostile environment. And, you know, I remember when I first started in this business, you know, we worked on a number of pitches back when. And, you know, it was really a different time. I wasn't thrilled about the idea of putting in so much free labor back then, but at least, you know, there were some pretty decent budgets that we were competing with. The competition also wasn't as extreme, but a lot has changed. And the amount of work that it takes to put together a pitch is tremendous. And the smaller the studio, the harder it is to actually allot the time to do this free labor. And so, you know, there's a number of problems that arise from this. The first problem, obviously, is that this practice naturally just benefits the bigger shops. And what that means is less diversity, right? So it's the bigger beasts that are allowed to compete and sometimes compete themselves into the ground you know, I don't want to just simply blame the free pitch for this, but we've seen a lot of amazing studios close their doors in the past few years.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that's because they had to do too much free work, or they took on too much work, or why do you think that happened?
It's probably a combination of factors. But I know, you know, just from speaking sort of offline with colleagues who are running studios that are, you know, probably slightly slightly larger than mine, but, you know, the entire process really, really drains them. And for every few pitches that you do, you know, the chances of winning are becoming slimmer and slimmer and slimmer, but the amount of work that you have to contribute on a free pitch is, you know, I would actually argue is possibly even growing. So, you know, the other issue with all of this, and this is sort of my personal soapbox, is the people that have the hardest time just competing in the workplace in general, right? This is women, this is minorities, this is anyone who's coming from like that sort of socioeconomic background where they already couldn't do the free internship that would have landed them contacts. You know, their parents don't have the right contacts. Like they're sort of the people who had to really work their way through every single step of the process. Those are the people that can't afford to pitch for free.
Right.
Right. It will be, you know, minority owned businesses and women owned businesses that are, you know, in the economic positions where this is just really not an option. And it kills me because I'll sit and hear, you know, all these conversations about how we need more diversity in our industry. We need more diversity. And I'm like, well, how are you going to get that diversity when the bulk of the work is generally going to the same people over and over and over again, because those are the people who can afford to continue to pitch for free until they land something.
I think that's an endemic system across, across many industries, but yeah.
And, you know, the creative services industry has been kind of decimated. Any creative, not just creative services, right? You see it in music, you see it in journalism. There's this level of free labor that's expected just to land the job. And to me, you know, the company's been around for 7.5, going on 8 years now. Take a look at our portfolio. Give us a call. Have a conversation with us. Talk to us about your project. I'm happy to, you know, exchange some ideas on a call. But to ask us to go in and put together this massive multi-page proposal and to do a bunch of, you know, free creative, you know, I don't walk into a salon and say, you know, I'd like to try out a hair color. Can you just, you know,
do that
give me some highlights and then I'll decide whether or not I'm going to use you. Yeah, it gets, or, you know, maybe I'll pay you if I like it. It's a really terrible, terrible system.
So what
but I think it's unfortunate.
What do you think the solution is? Like, what do you think people should do instead of requesting these free pitches?
I think the first thing we need is honesty and transparency. And I think that alone would go a really, really long way. For one, if I am being asked to pitch, I want to know how many people are being invited, right? Am I bidding against 12 companies or am I bidding against 3 companies? A lot of times, even the budgets aren't disclosed when we're doing this. So, you know, we've gone in and done a ton of free work, and then it turns out that the client barely has the money to pay us back for the work we've already done should we get this job.
Right, right.
Right. So we need some kind of a system that actually allows us to speak openly about these things. You know, there's this sort of culture of being really opaque on the side of the clients who don't want to disclose budgets and want to just sort of get bids and then, you know, figure out where the project is landing and want to basically minimize their risks to the point of absurdity, right, where they're asking people to give them creative solutions before they even commit to paying for them so that, you know, their risk is minimal, but the 10 or however many companies they're pitching are shouldering the cost of all the risk. And then, you know, on the part of the vendors, I think we all need to be a lot more strict about how much work we're willing to do for free, under what circumstances. Requesting transparency, requesting accountability, because we've been in situations where we never hear back, right? There's not even a courtesy phone call that says, hey guys, we're sorry, this is the reason why we went with somebody else.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen this on both sides. I've seen this being both, well, very often I've seen this being on the creator side of the process. And you really do have to be you have to be very adamant that you don't work for free across the board. And then on the vendor side, I've seen it quite a bit too, though, where people ask for work or whatever, or ideas. And then, oh, okay, if we decide we're going to do this project, we'll hire you. But by then they've done a ton of work. Yeah, I think that is very challenging. I also think what people think goes into creative projects, the expectations are often not in line with the reality. Like, people don't realize I have to do X amount of prep even to get you to the place where I can shoot your promo. And all of that is time that I need to get paid for.
Absolutely. You know, even to put together a written pitch, to put together just an estimate and a one-page proposal, can take multiple hours. Case in point, we had literally 6 proposals to do between last Thursday and Monday. And, that was 2 full days worth of work.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think
these were just written proposals. Like, they weren't very complicated, but it monopolized our time.
Right. I think the difference is that, I think it's what you said before, that where the business world still has to catch up with this sort of nimble freelancer entrepreneurial world. So in the past, let's say you're a big agency, maybe you're part of an ad agency. So there's overhead covering all this time and people are on salary and they're doing the pitches. So they're getting paid no matter what. But when you're you or you're me, you're actually getting paid directly for the work that you do. So it's a different mindset. It's like, if I do this work, but I have no project against it, I'm not getting paid. If you work for a big agency and you're on salary, you know, it's whatever. You're getting paid for that time that you're there.
You know, though, that said, I've got friends over at the larger agencies and, even for them, this is becoming more and more challenging because the budgets aren't what it used to be.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a big part of the problem is that we've got an industry that developed all of these processes for how we approach, jobs and approach vendors and vet vendors for projects. And all of these were set up in a very different era.
Right.
So if someone came to us and disclosed that they have $150,000 for a project and 5 other companies are bidding and we have 2 weeks to submit a proposal and they'd like to see some creative, I would seriously consider that. However, what we get these days is we're not going to disclose a number. We're not going to talk to you about how many people are pitching and you have 3 days.
Yeah.
And
it's a cost-benefit analysis, right? Yeah. And so you're like, just provide me the information so I know if it's worth my time or the risk up front.
Yeah. Or at least a budget range. Incidentally, of those 6 proposals that we put out, 2 came back saying that they had literally half of, what we put down as numbers to work with. And we asked both of these potential clients about their budget range on the initial call and said, we would prefer to have this number disclosed so that we propose something that's in line with reality. And both of these clients said, we'd rather you just do an open bid. And I said, okay, sure, that's what we're going to do. But, in the end, it wasted our time and it wasted their time because now they're sitting here looking at a proposal that may sound really good, but they can't afford.
Right. Yeah, I hear this quite a lot, actually. Do you find that because of the way TV has changed, so to make up an example, but the way TV has changed, let's say you're doing a campaign, and I'm going to talk specifically about television, even though I know you've got other kinds of clients, but that they expect not just broadcast assets, but potentially social assets and other assets, and aren't necessarily budgeting to pay for those.
Absolutely. Yeah, we get that a lot. And, you know, usually what winds up happening is, you know, this last minute list comes down with respect to all the different compressions and formats. And, you know, we try to be nice guys about it as much as we can. If it's just a question of recompressing a few files, no big deal. But we've certainly had instances where we had to look at this list and say, you know, this is absolutely not what we agreed to as part of deliverables. And, you know, this will be extra. And, you know, I think the hard thing is always, you know, where do you draw that line in the sand between being nice and also making sure that I can pay people's salaries?
Yeah. So where do you draw
that line? Not giving away work.
So where do you draw the line?
I think a lot of it has to do with what kind of a relationship we have established with a client. We have people that we've worked with for 10, 12 years. And, you know, we treat those clients very differently because it's, you know, those are beyond just client relationships.
Right.
Those are friendships.
Right. Yeah.
And so I know that there is a great deal of mutual respect there. And for me to throw them, you know, whatever extras we can, it's not a big deal. I think where I draw the line is especially with new clients or people who are, you know, who are already getting more, you know, mm-hmm. That's really where we try to be pretty strict, only because it sets up this precedent that we don't want to have to live up to every single time, where just because we can accommodate them once, it means we're going to accommodate them over and over and over again in a myriad of ways in
right.
which, you know, that's just not always possible. I think thankfully, you know, because we try to be very transparent about how we bill, what we're billing for, we keep our estimates very simple. We don't complicate the numbers. We'll openly talk about money. And I think, you know, that's been very helpful in educating our clients as to our process. And, you know, it almost never happens that someone comes to us and we come back and say that'll be extra and they're surprised. Normally they're, you know, if they haven't already mentioned that they've got an extra budget for this, you know, they may be hoping that we'll throw it in and they have their fingers crossed. But if we tell them it's going to be billable, you know, no one is generally surprised. But it does happen when people are expecting a Mercedes and want to pay for a bicycle.
Yeah, that's the second time I've heard that today. not from you either, from someone else. But do you feel like you can anticipate some of this? Like, let's say you're given they're saying, here's what we want to do. And you can look at it and say, you know, you are probably going to want whatever it is, Facebook campaign,
yeah.
Insta, blah, blah, blah. And can you kind of incorporate that in up front so they know what that's going to be? And so you can kind of head this off at the pass?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is really, that part of the equation is really on the side of the vendors. We are the people who are supposed to know better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I think that it's part of my job and it's part of me being a successful, helpful vendor to my client to say, you didn't think about this and you should probably think about that. And let's budget for it now so that if it comes up, it's not going to be a problem. So client, you know, I think client education is huge. And sometimes we just assume that people are going to know. But, you know, technology changes all the time. And an experience that we just had with one client, we could probably learn from and use for the next and make suggestions. So, you know, this isn't, I kind of want to make it clear that a lot of these things are, you know, the vendors can and should control for. But it comes to good communication and, again, transparency and honesty and taking the time in the beginning phases of the project or even, you know, talking about a project to try and get as much information and as much answers as we can from the clients.
It's amazing how much of life is just that, like just communicating, being honest, setting expectations. Like it's not.
Yeah, it's really, it's not brain surgery.
Yeah.
It's like, the motto that we have is we treat our clients as people, not as paychecks or titles. Because at the end of the day, it's not a company who calls us. It's, you know, Josh or Bob or Jane or whoever. And it's they have a project, and this project is their headache, and they need to make sure that it gets done on time and it gets done well. And, you know, as long as we remember that there's a human being on, or human beings on both sides of this equation, I think we could figure this out. But I think too often what happens is, you know, we forget that we're dealing with people, and that when, you know, a client calls us and says, a potential client, and says, hey, you know, we'd like you to pitch on this job and you have 48 hours to produce creative, they're forgetting that we're actual people who have other projects going on, right? Other commitments, other clients, lives of our own, and that it's not as simple as, you know, dropping everything that we've got going on to accommodate them.
We've had some interviews on here, actually, where people have talked a lot about how, I mean, whether you're trying to find a job, whether you're an agency looking to work with a client, on lots of different iterations of this, but it's really about being a problem solver. So for you, how am I solving the problems of my client? And beyond like thinking you're a human, but also, yes, anticipating their needs, setting their expectations, having honest conversations up front, all those kinds of things, that so that in the end, you've solved a problem for them and then they'll come back to you again and again.
Such is the hope.
Such is the hope. So looking down the road a bit, how do you see the way agencies like yours will work with clients? How do you see that evolving? And then B, if it's different, how would you like it to evolve?
Great questions. So I think my answer for both is the same. And my answer is, I think it's going to be about long-term relationships. And the reason I say this is that, you know, the entire process of finding vendors and vetting vendors is a big deal on the client side as well. And I both believe and also hope that where this is going to go is, you know, agencies really serving as extensions of their clients' departments and really getting to know them better. And, you know, we've definitely seen that happening with us already, where, again, I've mentioned we've had some really long-running relationships, both in broadcast and in digital. And I think what winds up happening is it becomes more cost-effective for the client side.
Yeah.
To have people who they know, who they trust, who know their brand, and who can deliver over and over and over, rather than going out and getting multiple bids from, you know, multiple new vendors every single time. With the turnaround times getting crazier and crazier, you know, and I hear this from clients, like they just want to have somebody on speed dial.
Right.
A lot of times these days, we're not actually pitching or bidding. We're just getting calls that say, hey, we need this. And that's it. And I believe that this is where things should be evolving towards, because, you know, as we keep talking, the budgets are getting smaller, the turnaround times are getting crazier. The expectations are still pretty high, but the list of deliverables is also growing. So this entire dance of pitching and budgeting and free creative, I mean, I'm hoping that just goes by the wayside because of the evolution of the industry and just becomes extinct, simply because there's not going to be time for it anymore.
Right. Well, Maria, thank you so very much for your time. We greatly appreciate it. It was lovely chatting with you.
You as well. Thank you.
A big shout out to the sponsors of this episode, our friends at 2C Creative. If you're looking for an award-winning agency to handle all of your creative needs, from 360 integrations to live action, design, trailers, and editorial, head to www.2c.tv. Paige Albiniak is editorial director of Promax BDA. LaFern Cusack is executive producer of the Daily Brief podcast and senior producer at Promax BDA. Video helper provided the music. Digital producer Kate LaKire Marion and social media coordinator Kristen Craik contribute to Daily Brief. Follow Paige on Twitter at Paige A. Follow LaFern at LaFern Cusack. Follow Promax BDA at Promax BDA. You can reach out to us at dailybrief@promaxbda.org. Subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.